Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 1400 hours on Friday, the 2nd of August, these are our main stories. Japan has imposed new tariffs against South Korea in a row that Seoul says stems from the Second World War era Japanese atrocities. The US has officially withdrawn from a landmark nuclear weapons treaty with Russia, stoking fears of a new arms race. And Libya has announced it will close three of its largest migrant detention centres. Also in this podcast, Moscow has sent the army to fight wildfires in Siberia, but critics are sceptical.
Army is not specialized in fighting fires. Of course, there would be some help, but it would not raise the capacity accordingly.
And dog walking has been banned in China's capital city, Beijing. Japan's list of trusted trade partners includes all those countries which enjoy minimum trade restrictions. Now, South Korea is no longer one of them. The move is part of an intensifying row that has its roots in a troubled history and has led to a number of protests on the streets of Seoul. It's also prompted an angry reaction from the South Korean president, Moon Jae-in.
우리 정부는 지금도
Even at this moment, the South Korean government does not want a vicious cycle of tit-for-tat. There's only one way to stop this. The Japanese government must withdraw its unilateral and unwarranted measures as soon as possible and take a path towards dialogue.
Our correspondent Laura Bicker is in Seoul.
The sound you hear above the music is the thud and thwack of a South Korean man smashing his own Japanese car. This is the level of anger and defiance some South Koreans feel after Tokyo slapped trade restrictions on Seoul. He's not alone in his fury. Outside the Japanese embassy, protesters slap a fake Shinzo Abe with kimchi, a South Korean delicacy made with fermented cabbage. The trade spat has also prompted thousands of South Koreans to boycott Japanese goods. Hundreds of items have been taken off supermarket shelves. Sales of Japanese beer are down by 60% in some marts.
Japan took action, and as Korean citizens, we should act fast as well. So we haven't been using any Japanese products.
We often used to go on vacation to Japan, but now we don't. We've even recently cancelled our trip to Japan.
This dispute has its roots in historical grievances and decades of distrust after the Japanese occupation of Korea. I'm in a prison which the Japanese built in Seoul. They occupied this country from 1910 to 1945. They used this prison to silence dissent and crush those who spoke out against Imperial Japan. I'm in a tiny cell. It was made to hold several people, and you can just glimpse out the window and through the bars if you stand on your tiptoes. There are also torture rooms in this prison. It is a time that South Koreans have never forgotten, and more importantly, they've never forgiven. Tens of thousands of Koreans were forced to work in Japanese mines and steel mills without pay during the Second World War. They say they were treated as slaves by Tokyo. Footage taken by the Japanese for propaganda shows young, underweight Korean men deep underground collecting coal for Tokyo's war effort. Japan maintains these issues were resolved by a treaty signed in 1965. The Japanese government paid $800 million in aid and loans for its wartime atrocities. But a Supreme Court ruling in Seoul last year overturned part of that accord and decided workers and their families were owed compensation. South Korea believes Tokyo's trade restrictions are a form of targeted retaliation for the court orders. Japan says this is not true. They say it's not about historical differences, but about protecting national security. They've hit some of Seoul's biggest industries, such as Samsung, who rely on Japan for essential supplies to produce memory chips and other components vital for smartphones, laptops and TV screens. The pain won't just be felt here. It could ripple through global tech supply chains. And that may prompt America to step in.
Laura Bicker. Now, as Laura mentioned, the trade row between Japan and South Korea is a cause for concern in the US. And Mike Pompeo, the American Secretary of State, is in talks with both sides. But Washington is involved in its own high-profile trade row with China. And with no sign of a resolution between Washington and Beijing, President Trump has announced new US tariffs on $300 billion worth of Chinese imports. That decision took many investors by surprise, as our Asia business correspondent Karishma Vaswani told me.
Remember, it comes after the negotiations between the U.S. and China that were taking place in Shanghai this week. Negotiations which both sides had said had been constructive. But the ramifications of the trade tariffs that President Trump has now threatened to slap on Chinese goods, $300 billion worth of Chinese goods on September the 1st, will certainly put future negotiations at risk. What we've heard from the Chinese Foreign Ministry today is that scheduled talks in September, they say, are now very much in Washington's court.
Yes, so as you say, a continuing US-China trade war. But now this friction between Japan and South Korea, what does all this mean for the regional and the wider global economy?
Well, in a nutshell, it basically means that supply chains or the way that companies source their products is being put at risk. If you look at the US-China issue, many Asian companies and American companies that produce their goods in China are now seeing those goods going into the United States being slapped with tariffs. That means they need to figure out where should they produce their products so that they won't be slapped with those tariffs in the future. Some of them are already moving out of China. Others are taking a wait-and-see approach. All of this takes time and money. The Japan and South Korea issue has similar repercussions. Japanese companies selling their products to South Korea now, chemical manufacturers, for instance, will have to get an export license from their own government. South Korean firms now have to figure out where do they source these chemicals in order for them to go into components like chips and laptops and smartphones so that they can continue to provide those products to customers. All of this puts the global supply chain at risk and potentially makes products more expensive for me and you.
Karishma Vaswani. More than 30 years ago, US President Ronald Reagan and Soviet Union leader Mikhail Gorbachev signed a treaty halting the development of medium-range missiles in an attempt to curb the nuclear arms race. But today, the Trump administration has formally withdrawn from that treaty, accusing Russia of developing a new type of cruise missile. Moscow denies the claims. The NATO Secretary General, Jens Stoltenberg, has vowed to respond in a measured and responsible way.
We will not mirror what Russia does. We don't want a new arms race. And we have no intention to deploy new land-based nuclear missiles in Europe. NATO continues to aspire for a constructive relationship with Russia when Russia's actions make that possible.
Thomas Countryman is the former US Assistant Secretary of State for International Security and Non-Proliferation. He's also chairman of the Board of Directors at the Arms Control Association in Washington. And he spoke to my colleague, Carney Sharp.
The US, by responding to the Russian violation, by pulling out of the treaty, is perhaps creating the conditions for a replay of the 1980s when the U.S. and the Soviet Union went tit for tat on nuclear missile deployments. We're far from that stage yet, but it does represent a genuine escalation between NATO and Russia, and it has more implications for the security of Europe than it does for either the United States or Russia.
So was this a wise move on the part of President Trump?
No. As I told the House Foreign Affairs Committee last week, it is a justifiable move because Russia violated the treaty first. But justifiable is not the same thing as smart.
But by not reacting in this way, wouldn't Russia continue breaching its terms, though?
Russia is delighted to be freed as of today from the restrictions of the INF Treaty. The Soviet military and later the Russian military never liked the fact that it could not build missiles of this range when other neighbors besides NATO were doing so. The United States administration, I think, is also happy to be free so that they can build missiles of this range to counter the Chinese arsenal. I think that this is likely to lead to a response from NATO that will simply raise tension and that foreshadows a very bad time for the other existing arms control agreements we have.
Whilst you say, though, that this may not have been the wisest move, and you mention NATO there, members are unusually behind President Trump on this decision.
They have endorsed the United States' decision to withdraw from the treaty. They're not happy about the very unilateral way the United States approached the issue. They are not satisfied, I think, that no effort has been made to preserve the treaty or to find an alternative.
So just take us back to the actual signing of this treaty. Why was it so significant?
Yes, several things that made it truly groundbreaking. First, the NATO alliance and the Soviet Union were in a condition where either could have launched an attack on the other's major capitals. So the treaty ended that particular crisis and laid the groundwork for further progress in Western relations with the Soviets. Second, it was the first treaty in history that eliminated an entire category of weapons. And third, it established a very basic principle that's important to arms control, which is it allowed two nations that distrusted each other to actually do on-the-ground inspections on each other's territory. We're losing all of that precedent, and I think we are also eroding the controls that we have on the long-range, larger nuclear warheads that the U.S. and Russia point at each other.
Thomas Countryman speaking to the BBC's Connie Sharp. Libya's Interior Minister Fathi Bashagha has announced plans to shut down three of the North African country's largest migrant detention centres. Migrants are being put at increasing risk by Libya's civil war as the opposition forces of Field Marshal Khalifa Haftar try to topple the internationally recognised Libyan government. The BBC's Nick Springate reports.
The detention centres at Misrata, Tajura and Al-Khalms have been struggling to cope with the number of migrants arriving in the country whose aim is to reach the shores of Europe. Conditions in the centres have been criticised as inhumane by human rights organisations and some European governments. Many of the migrants, predominantly from sub-Saharan Africa, have been caught in the fighting between the UN-backed government in Tripoli and forces loyal to General Khalifa Haftar, who's based in Benghazi. More than 40 migrants were killed in July when a missile hit the detention centre in Tajura. Now it's feared that traffickers would exploit the situation. 8 days ago, 150 migrants drowned after they left Libya bound for Europe. And last night, 20 bodies were recovered from the shores east of Tripoli.
Nick Springate. This weekend, download your roundup of the week's news with The World This Week.
Both are tech giants, both strong Asian allies of America, so you might think South Korea and Japan would be the best of friends. You'd be utterly wrong. We look at the latest flare-up in their relations. Despite a new truce in Idlib, the remaining rebel bastion in Syria, people there still face a desperate situation, as our regional expert explains. Also, China uses a video to warn Hong Kong demonstrators. Russia clamps down yet again against the opposition. And Ethiopia claims it can plant 4 billion trees in a matter of months.
That's The World This Week, available for download each weekend from the BBC World Service. Still to come in this podcast, demand for cognac is booming in the US thanks to some of rap music's biggest stars.
The ultimate cognac theme song was Busta Rhymes and Pharrell and Diddy with Passa Cavarsier.
And we hear about a Russian man who won a lawsuit against psychics after they failed to save his marriage. For weeks, forest fires have raged across Russia's vast eastern province of Siberia. Initially, Moscow said it would not try to put the fires out, but now the government has sent in the Russian army to fight the blazes. Anton Benislavsky is a firefighting expert with the environmental group Greenpeace. He spoke to Carney Sharp.
Summers normally were hot and warm in Siberia, but with the climate change, they become much drier and hotter. And the fires we witnessed in last decades, and especially this year, is partly amplified by the change of the climate and the weather.
So now you've got the Russian army being sent in to tackle these fires, but I was reading that this is going to worsen the situation.
So I would say that army would not worsen the ecological situation, but army is not specialized in fighting fires. So to mobilize army is the same as to mobilize just local people to fight fires. It is a very risky, high-risk professional activity. Of course, there would be some help, but it would not raise the capacity accordingly.
And this Siberia, we know it's sparsely populated. It's home, though, to a quarter of Russia's population. It could potentially impact on people's health.
These fires already impact public health because the smoke which comes to the big cities of Siberia is quite dense. And for example, in 2010, we have a statistics that smoke inhalation, the same smoke pollution in Moscow, caused 50,000 premature deaths and a lot of diseases. The population is not so dense in Siberia, but the results of the smoke inhalation could be like thousands of premature deaths.
Anton Benislavsky. Sales of cognac, the brandy that comes from a specific region of France, have been flagging in Europe. But in the US, demand is booming. And it's all thanks to hip-hop music. The BBC's Elizabeth Hodson reports. I need a witness,
got a Hennessy in my hand. Last year, nearly 98% of cognac was exported, and by far the biggest market is the USA. And in large part, the industry has got American rap and hip-hop music to thank.
The ultimate cognac theme song was Busta Rhymes and Pharrell and Diddy with Patek Kavarsie.
Candace McDuffie is a music journalist from Boston.
Kanye was infamously drinking Hennessy at the MTV 2009 Video Music Awards right before he interrupted Taylor Swift and had that whole controversy surrounding him. It's really been a staple in the black community, and I think it's important to remember that rap, music, and hip-hop was always about black struggle, and Hennessy is so important to black people because of their connections to us historically, right? During the time where segregation was still legal, they hired a black marketing vice president, which was huge.
At the recent cognac show in London, I met Dawn Davis, head buyer at the Whiskey Exchange.
Cognac in itself, sort of 5 years ago, was very static as a category. There was no innovation, there was no kind of drive. They were very much looking outside of the European market. So now I think what we're seeing is the houses are really starting to open their eyes and try new things.
And in the hallowed vineyards of cognac, revolution is in the air.
I am Alexandre Gabriel, owner and master blender at Maison Ferrand, making Cognac Ferrand. In cognac right now, there is a soft revolution. Cognac legally right now has to be aged only in oak barrels. I've gone another way, making barrels in a chestnut tree. Now you think I'm crazy. It's delicious, but by law, I cannot call it cognac. Regulation needs to be evolving.
And maybe if he succeeds, cognac will be able to revive its European fortunes.
Elizabeth Hodson with that report. If you're a dog owner in the Chinese capital, Beijing, you can no longer take your pet for a walk in public parks, as the authorities have banned it. Our China media analyst Kerry Allen told me more.
There have been a number of regulations that have been introduced in the last week, which include dog walking, fishing as well. And they were signalled back in April that this was going to happen. It all ties into a controversial social credit system China's introducing from next year. So it's cracking down on what it sees as uncivilised behaviours. And it's already in Beijing cracked down on things like people eating on the subways, man-spreading even. But dog walking is the latest regulation that's been introduced. And it's particularly because there's been some complaints from people about people not picking up their rubbish after their dogs, and also fears that some dogs are not on leads and they could be violent. They could attack small children, for example.
So what's the reaction been?
Well, there's been mixed reaction because it's got a lot of strays in the country. So there are lots of reports constantly about people getting attacked and concerns about this. So some people say that they think it's a good idea for people's safety. But others are concerned because where are you going to take your dog now to walk them? There have been some pictures on Sina Weibo, which is China's equivalent of Facebook or Twitter, which show people late at night walking their dogs in order to, because there's not a lot of people around, so it's safer. So that's one way people are getting around it. But some people are saying that your dog, it's not a case of dogs being violent if they're off a lead. The dog is as good as the owner. So it's more about owners improving their conduct and looking after their dogs rather than if a dog's off a leash, it means it's a threat.
Kerry Allen with that report. Now we come to the final part of our podcast when we will tell you about a few less reported stories from around the world. With me in the studio is Martin Morgan from the BBC monitoring team, which follows local news in several languages. Martin, thanks for joining us. Now, some Russian psychics may find themselves in trouble with the law after a recent court ruling. What's happened there?
Well, what's happened is in Siberia, there's a man who wants to get back together with his estranged wife. And he saw an advert on TV by a company of psychics who said that we can, quote, win back your wife or sweetheart for you. So he agreed with them, handed over $5,000 in Russian money. And unfortunately, it didn't work out. So he decided that he was going to take them to court and sued them under the Consumer Rights Act.
And what was the court's ruling?
Well, they found in his favour. The judge said that regardless of the outcome, whether the wife came back or not, this company didn't show any evidence that it had done anything, magical or otherwise, to lure this lady back to the family home, and basically ruled that it was breach of contract.
OK, that is the most extraordinary story of the day so far. But also in Uzbekistan, Central Asia, people have been taking to the streets after their homes were demolished. What can you tell me about this?
That's right. Well, in Uzbekistan, the government's been demolishing entire residential areas in order to clear space for new factory building. Now, the law says you can do this, but you have to pay compensation. You've got to provide alternative accommodation. This hasn't been happening in lots of parts of the country. And in Urgench, in the north of the country, things came to a head this week when hundreds of people basically tore down this tent city they'd been put in and chased the regional governor out of town. And tempers have been rising over this. Last week, a local official in the south of the country was set on fire when he tried to demolish a businessman's building. Fortunately, the man did recover. But the government's obviously taken this on board, and the Prime Minister of Uzbekistan flew up to Urgench and basically ordered local officials to hand out wads of money in compensation to people to try to forestall this. And the president has said from now on there will be no more demolitions without prior agreement by the central government, because the last thing they want is, you know, this sort of trouble on the streets spilling over and spiralling out of control.
And one other story. In Vietnam, there's a campaign to limit the use of balloons at school celebrations. What's going on here?
Right then, yes. Well, a high school student in Hanoi wrote to all the headmasters or head teachers in the city this summer to say, when this new school year starts in the end of August, maybe we shouldn't release all the hundreds of balloons that we do to celebrate it, because her concern is this, that, you know, after everyone's enjoyed the spectacle, these balloons end up in the sea, animals, birds swallow them and get killed. Now, her headmaster wrote back and said, yes, I think this is a great idea. We're not going to do it. And he wants other schools to follow suit. And it's gone national because the environment minister wrote back to the student and said, I think you're setting a really important example. Your small act could have massive implications for the planet. And he now wants Vietnamese schools not only to go balloon free, but in fact entirely plastic free.
Martin, thank you. News from elsewhere with Martin Morgan from BBC Monitoring. And you'll hear that at the same time in this podcast every week. And that is all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, including psychics, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.